typically tantrums are short. They should be short. And usually they peak at around 3.5 years, and they're usually on average 2 minutes.
Children don't come with an instruction manual. And as parents, we're often making it up as we go along and hoping for the best. But when it comes to the unique delights of toddlerhood, well, all bets are off. How do we deal with the dreaded toddler tantrum, and how do we get them to say yes instead of no, no, no? And pray tell, just how do we get them to eat their vegetables? Well, while I haven't quite written that instruction manual or figured it out myself, we think we've got the next best thing. Michelle Tangeman is a mother of two, a therapist and a behaviour expert, and she joins us today to discuss whether we can, and indeed should we, tame the toddler. So Michelle, welcome to This Little Life. Thank you so much for joining us today. And for those who haven't crossed paths with you, perhaps you can tell us a little bit about yourself and what inspired you to work with children and families.
Yes, of course. Again, thank you for having me. So I am Michelle, and I'm a mom of two. Currently, my children are 3 and 6. So I'm kind of wrapping up my toddler years and entering a new phase of parenting. But either way, I'm well-versed clinically, but also well-versed just as a human and as a mom. So I started my career as a therapist right away, like right after undergraduate. I went straight into graduate school. And really what inspired me to kind of pursue just the field of psychology in general is, as a young child, there were periods of my childhood that, you know, felt very chaotic and messy, and I wasn't quite sure what was going on. And the reason for that was, is I have, my father was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia when I was 6 years old.
Goodness. Wow.
And so I didn't really know what that meant, of course, as a child. And I didn't know what that really was until I was actually in college. I learned about the diagnosis not until I was in high school. My parents separated when I was young, but really that's kind of what launched me into the field of psychology. And then in terms of working with children and families, that just kind of happened organically. And I spent most of my years in clinical practice working with children and families across various locations here in California, in the greater Los Angeles area. And then when I had my own children, you know, I decided to kind of pull away from my agency job and then start my private practice and then start Thriving Toddler as a way to provide education and support for moms. Because despite having the education and experience that I have, I found toddlerhood to be extremely challenging. So I was just hoping to be an extra resource for parents.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I, you know, think we always talk about toddlers and watch out for those terrible twos, but you don't really appreciate it until you actually hit that point in your life.
Correct. And for me as a clinician, it was, I got to go into these homes and work with the children, but I got to leave. And as a parent, you don't just get to leave. And so it's absolutely a very different experience.
Yeah, fantastic. And I know that the first few years in our child's life are always watching for those, that next milestone, or the, you know, is my child developing properly? But what are those, some of those key development milestones that parents should watch for in toddlers?
Yeah, that's a great question. The first thing I want to say, just before I kind of give some of the list here, is that I know that as a, maybe even as a new mom and a first time mom, you may get really fixated on where your child should be. And what I want to say just in general is that I think what's most important is have an idea of what these developmental milestones are. But what really matters is if your child is making progress, right? So making sure that they're on their own growth curve, rather than, I think, falling into this comparison trap, whether it be through looking through social media or going through mom groups or just being out in the community. I think it's really easy to fall into this, like, well, what is this child doing compared to my child? And I think that that can provoke a lot of anxiety. So I think it's helpful to know, and it's important to know, but it's also making sure you're looking at your own child and making sure they're following, you know, kind of their own growth chart.
Yeah.
So some of the key things I would look for, you know, and again, there's a range. So between 18 and 24 months, some of the things that you're really going to start to see that they're either starting or they're kind of mastering are just being able to follow one-step directions. things like, come here, can I have this? Being able to sort through their toys, right? So maybe you have various toys and they're kind of putting them in piles, whether it's prompted or unprompted, usually prompted, requires some parent participation there. They're learning how to relinquish items. It's really hard to give up, especially something that you really like and that's highly preferred to the child. Maybe you're going to start seeing them run. Maybe you'll start seeing them kick a ball, making animal sounds. A really big one for me that I'm looking for is joint attention and joint referencing. That's a really good indicator of supporting language development and their social skills. So what that means in terms of looking for joint attention and joint referencing is the easiest example I can give you is like you're outside. You're playing with your child, you see an airplane in the sky and you look up and you point and you're saying, look, it's an airplane, and your child is meeting you. They're referencing you and they're referencing the sky to look for the airplane. So really looking for that and making sure that that's there. At this time, they're asking yes or no questions. They're learning and mastering cause and effect in their play. They're starting to engage in these make-believe activities. What a fun time, toddlerhood. And then I hope that you're starting to see them comfort others in distress, right? Really great beginning to see like their empathy developing for other people. And then also very common at this period of time is showing frustration when they're not understood. So just know that if they're getting frustrated quite frequently at you because you don't quite understand what they're saying, that is absolutely normal.
It's very cute, isn't it? When, obviously they're not in that ability to communicate what they're trying to think. And, you know, I do remember back to Olive and Freddie when they used to get quite frustrated and they'd throw the things on the ground and stomp off, which I always thought you'd giggle at. I'm sure that's the wrong parental response, but it was always very cute. I'm learning a lot more now, obviously, around how I should have done it. But anyway, we'll do that next time round. But tell me about this, Michelle. You know, we always talk about, obviously, those terrible twos and those toddler tantrums. I mean, what do we see? Is that sort of a typical behavior in this group and in this age group, should I say? And what is your advice to dealing with those situations?
Yeah, absolutely. Temper tantrums are part of this period of development. And what I want to say about toddlerhood is that it's a very unique time in human development, in that the pivotal, I would say, like the big thing about toddlerhood is that they have a strong desire to stay with their attached caregivers, like their attachment and the caregivers that they're closest to. And then they have an equally strong desire to explore their environment. Because think about all of the skills that they've acquired in a short amount of time, thinking about their cognitive skills, thinking about their locomotion, their motor skills, thinking about the social skills. There's so much. They're rapidly learning so much about their world. And so it's like, I want to go explore, but at the same time, I really want to stay close to my caregiver. And it's this push and pull. And that's really what toddlerhood is. And so my best advice is that I have four things that I want to share with all parents. And I like to try and follow it in this order. The first thing is stay as calm as you can and as regulated as you can to the best of your ability. I know that, you know, depending on your circumstance as a parent, there's lots of different scenarios, and you could be absolutely sleep deprived, not getting a lot of sleep. So maybe you're not able to maybe function in a way that you would like to. But I think the most important thing is to model self-regulation and model calmness in their chaos. So that's one. Number two is don't take the tantrum personally. I know that some parents don't, and they're really good about this, but oftentimes I'm actually quite surprised that most parents take their child's tantrum personally. And sometimes I hear it more so from dads, especially if mom is the primary caregiver, or if you have one caregiver and then the other caregiver takes it a little bit more personally because they are showing a stronger desire for the other. So not to take the tantrum personally, because they simply do not know, and they are learning how to navigate their big feelings. So that's number two. Number three, while the tantrum is happening, my best advice is just to wait it out. because there's really no reasoning that you can do, even for an adult. Think about a moment in your life where you were highly dysregulated. What happens is your amygdala is overactivated. And when that's activated, the frontal lobe is starting to, I mean, it's still active, but it's not as strong. And so we really need to calm the body, calm the mind before you can start to try and reason or provide direction. So waiting it out, typically tantrums are short. They should be short. And usually they peak around 3.5 years, and they're usually on average 2 minutes. When we're talking about tantrums that go beyond like 20 minutes, then that's potentially a red flag for something else. Not always, but that means something else is going on and it needs to be investigated just a little bit further. Then the fourth thing I want parents to know is, this is not often talked about, but this is something I think is highly critical. And what a behavior analyst would say is taking a functional look at the tantrum. Behaviors are communication. Tantrums are communication. Typically, it could be something as simple as, I see that they want this toy and they can't have it. So now that set off a tantrum. But sometimes it's not that clear. And it could be that they're overtired. It could be that they're hungry. It could be that maybe they're getting sick. And so tantrums are going to happen in those moments. But taking a functional look at a behavior means what's happening right before the tantrum. So if your tantrum is related to, oh, I said no, and you can't have that, then making sure you follow through with that and you don't actually give the object unless they're calm and they can functionally ask for it. Because you're teaching through your behavior, through your responding, that that tantrum isn't going to be rewarded. And instead, I'm going to ask you to say it nicely or to the best of your ability based on your age, and then I will happily give it to you. Or a big one, big thing, human behavior in general is very attention-driven. Like we want the attention, especially as toddlers, the attention of our caregiver. It's gold. And so you could be on the phone or you could be on the phone talking to somebody, or you could be making dinner, for example. You could be doing laundry. And if you're not paying attention and they want your attention, sometimes acting out behaviorally is their way of getting your attention. So be mindful of what you're responding to in terms of behavior. Because what happens is parents inadvertently reinforce the tantrum. And so tantrums are more likely to happen in the future. So parents do have agency and control over potentially the frequency and duration of your child's tantrum, even though that they are very developmentally appropriate. So that's why I like to kind of add that in there. It's good to be aware of what's setting the child off.
It's really interesting because I probably should be getting some tips around my soon-to-be 12-year-old, because it still feels like this is appropriate for a 12-year-old. I'm like, I'm taking notes.
And I'm so glad you mentioned that, because this, like when you take a functional approach, this is actually relevant through the lifespan. Yes. So it starts in toddlerhood. And if you can kind of master these as a parent in toddlerhood and carry those lessons with you, that makes a dramatic change in how your house functions.
Yeah, well, it's only now, obviously, you know, by meeting so many fabulous experts in this podcast forum, that I'm starting to really, you know, understand, you know, the different parenting ways, and, you know, whether it's reinforcement or as acknowledgement, all these things I never knew when I was sort of becoming a, you know, dealing with all these different stages. And now that I'm starting to read it, I'm like, oh my goodness, oh, I could have handled that so much better. And I'm trying to learn, but it's really funny because in the heat of the moment, it's like your brain goes blank and you're like, I know how I should respond to this, but I don't know what to do. And with a 12-year-old, I just walk away now and just go, we'll leave it for later, I think, and we'll come back to it. But I'm thinking, I know the tools, but I can't remember. So I wonder, what's the advice to parents in that heat of the moment? I mean, stay calm. I hear that one all the time. But sometimes you just can't remember. And then you think, God, so what's your advice? What's your thoughts when you're right there in the middle of it?
Yeah. You know, and this goes back to my point that I mentioned earlier, and it's that when we're activated as parents, our frontal lobe capacity is now decreased. And so that's why it's so important to stay regulated, because then you're more likely to behave and engage in a way that feels good to you, right? That you're proud of, that is value driven for you. But I think in the heat of the moment, what you did sometimes you just have to walk away so that you can get regulated and come back and have the situation. I think that that's really great. There are some personality types as adults, I'm talking about adults now, where like you've probably know those people, or maybe you are that person where you like, no, I need to address this right now. We need to solve this right now. But maybe that's not the best time to do it. Yeah. Right. So maybe just hitting pause and saying, I promise I will come back to this, but I'm not regulated here in my mind, and I'm not regulated here in my body. So just let me get back to that and let's have a productive conversation.
Yeah, that's really good advice. And I suppose one of the things in that situation we talk about in the heat of the moment and the anxiety for both the child and the parent, it feels like a natural segue to talk about daycare. Because I know that, you know, particularly here in Australia, New Zealand, and certainly in the States, you know, there's a lot of mums returning to work sooner than ever before, you know, and having to deal with the anxiety and the mum guilt and the parent guilt that comes with putting your child in and your toddler in daycare. You know, what are your thoughts around that? I mean, I think it's fabulous, but I obviously did deal with the anxiety, but I found daycare to be a place where the children would thrive enormously. But what are your thoughts and what are your advice to new parents who are embarking on the daycare handoff?
I think the best, for me and my perspective, the best thing is what's right for you and your family. Like, we don't want to be driven by fear and anxiety, right? So like, if you're aware enough to say like, I'm really anxious about this, is it holding me back from my values? Then let's explore that more. Right. So I think it takes a great deal of insight. But regardless of what you choose, whether it's daycare or not, preschool or not, it's really ultimately up to you as a parent and how you want your family system to look and how you want your young children to develop. There are benefits and drawbacks to any decision that you make in any point in parenting, you know, and I know that there's long lists of them. I don't know all of them off the top of my head, but I know with I personally am a mom that it loves daycare. Both my kids started preschool at 2 years old. I was with them for the first 2 years, but I also had young children during the pandemic. So I was somewhat forced, right, to keep them at home. But both of my children started preschool at two, and it's been the best thing. And I think the biggest benefit really is that is the social piece, is that they have the opportunity to engage more frequently with the social world. But you know, the drawbacks there too is that it's also developmentally appropriate at this stage for them to be mimicking their peers. So if you've got peers that are engaging in a lot of bad behavior or undesired behavior, they're likely bringing that home. And that's something you're going to have to address at home and hope that your caregivers in the preschool or daycare setting are also addressing that appropriately. So I think that that's the biggest thing to keep an eye out. And that's a drawback of maybe going to preschool, but not a deal breaker. Definitely not a deal breaker.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And yeah, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. You go ahead.
The other thing is, you know, there's behavior analysts, we like to look at, we're very research oriented. And there's these, it's called toddler life skills. And I actually, this is something I like to teach in my programs. And so if you're a parent that wants to do daycare or doesn't want to do daycare, it doesn't matter. If you are teaching to these 11 skills, you're setting your child up for success. And that's something that I kind of teach and talk about a lot in the toddler life skills. But it's behaviors like requesting for assistance, being consistent in your delivery, and then your follow through, following one step directions, and then multiple step directions. And then a big one, being able to tolerate when a delay is imposed on the child by an adult or by a peer, because that's really, really hard at this age.
So can you help me understand what you mean by that last point there, Michelle?
Yeah. So like when somebody says, okay, so let's say, this often happens to me and my child. So like my child is always hungry. And so I hear at pickup that he's like asking for food quite often. And I know that he is well fed, right? Like I know he's fed here and then I pack plenty of snacks and it always comes home empty. He's got a great lunch, but he's still asking for it. So when the adult says, no, it's not time for a snack, he has to be able to tolerate the delay of access to the food, which is food is reinforcing to him.
Uh-huh.
Right. So if that's that's what the adult is imposing on the child. And then what happens peer on peer? Two toddlers get together and they see the same truck and they both go after it, but one child gets it, the other doesn't. That's now there's been a delay that's been imposed on the one child that doesn't have access to the truck, and kids have to be able to tolerate that. And I find that that particular skill is really actually harder for parents to follow through on, because it's hard for us to see our kids in distress. But that's a really critical, valuable skill that we want them to be able to develop in the toddler years.
Yeah, that is a big one. I certainly remember that. It was the old advice around let the child finish playing and then you can play with it. But I'm still not sure that that necessarily worked. But tell me, you know, in that sort of same vein, you know, I suppose you're in a world where participation awards and sticker charts and even bribery with the lolly jar are common in terms of, you know, getting the desired response from a child. But where do we find the right balance, I suppose? What does positive reinforcement become too much? And how can parents strike that delicate balance between encouragement and excess?
Yeah, so this is a great question. I know it's very popular and on the top of minds of many parents. And here's what I would say is that the best form of reinforcement is making contact with natural reinforcement. So if your child likes positive praise, which most children like the positive attention from the parent, that's potentially going to increase the desired behavior. So something as simple as just acknowledging all the good behaviors that you see on an ongoing basis is sometimes enough. And that's intervention in itself. And some children don't need more. But we also know that all children are different. They all have unique needs. And some children have very different temperaments. So even within one house, you could have one child that's very mellow and cool-tempered. And then you have another child that is the complete opposite. So those strategies no longer work. So I think it's important to look at the individual child and say, okay, I've tried something natural. It's not working. Okay, what are my other options here? Maybe then it's time to create, like if you are a parent that is struggling with one particular behavior, like biting or hitting or scratching or throwing, all common in toddlerhood, then maybe it's time to think about some kind of age-appropriate rewards chart. Now, what often doesn't get talked about is that any kind of behavioral intervention, like a reward system that we're putting into place, is not meant to be permanent. And I think that that's a common error that ends up happening, is that we go on the internet, we search, and there's lots of great how-tos, but nobody's ever really talking about the appropriate way to fade those systems out. Because the idea is if a parent is struggling with one particular behavior, you have to create that motivation to kind of bridge that gap to make contact with natural reinforcement. And once that's made consistently and you start to see the decrease of the behavior, then you can start to gradually reduce your reward system. But that usually doesn't happen in your everyday house. And so I think that that's really important to keep in mind, is that's where you strike the balance, is how is my child doing? Are they generalizing this in the home and then into the school? Is it now time to kind of reduce the reward chart, and are they making contact with natural reinforcement in their environment?
It's interesting because one of the things that I do find that gets a desired response or an undesirable response, if I might do, and I see it more and more with younger children, is obviously around screen time and the iPads and the phones and things like that, which I find enormously impressive when I see a two-year-old functioning an iPhone better than I can. But, you know, I mean, it always brings up a lot of debate, you know, giving children iPads and screen time and things like that. But from your perspective, what is that, you know, an appropriate amount of screen time for a child or for a toddler? And, you know, is it one of those things that we should be using as a reward or a, you know, repercussion if a behavior is not done? What are your thoughts on that sort of that area of toddlerhood and parenting?
Yeah, that's really great. Okay, so there's two questions here. So, you know, I kind of default to, of course, I'm here in the United States, so I kind of default to the American Academy of Pediatrics And so I kind of follow those guidelines. And the guidelines for between 18 and 24 months is really just you have to watch together as parents or caregivers, and it's educational programming and it should be minimal. Certainly out there in the world, I see 2-year-olds navigating the little phones and tablets. I don't want to impose any judgment. I don't know what the circumstances are for that family. So again, it's kind of going back to like, what's important to you? And at this age, the more face-to-face engagement you have, the better for our brains. They were wired to make contact with other humans. And so I think that that's, when I look at it from a developmental perspective, that's what I'm looking at. There are times, now, with that said, kind of tying this back to the reward system, I usually do not incentivize early on, so like 6 and younger, with TV time, screen time, phone time, or whatever. Let's just call it screen time. It's all encompassing. I usually don't tie that together if there needs to be a reward system. So in my house, again, I mentioned my children are 3 and 6. We follow a token economy system. It's a very proactive way for us to reinforce really great positive behaviors across the board. But the reward bucket doesn't include any screen time. And that's what's right for my family. However, when I am pushing into the homes of clients where we're talking about big, severe behaviors, that's something different because I have to look at the unique needs of the children. What are they motivated for? Is this item going to potentially be reinforcing? It gets really tricky. It gets really tricky when we're talking about neurodiversity and neurodivergent children. And that's typically what I'm seeing in the home. And so those systems may look different. And I may make the recommendation that, yes, you should withhold video games, and that should be earned towards, you know, that should be an opportunity to be earned.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Gotcha. And what is the, I mean, as we sort of wrap up for the day, the two questions I just had. The first one is we talked earlier about the tantrums and if they go over 20 minutes. What does, just circling back on that one, what, you know, what is that if they are over 20 minutes? What potentially does that, you know, suggest, or what could that be a signal of in terms of a child's development?
Yeah. So for seeing, you know, pretty consistently, especially across environments where these tantrums are pretty lengthy in duration. One, that could be a simple response, like how are the parents responding? Because like if you keep trying to engage, and that continues to escalate the child, it could be just simply like, hey, I just need you to take a break and let's sit down and then let's just give your child an opportunity. But if that's not the case, then maybe we're looking at something that's a little bit bigger. Usually it could be related to neurodiversity, or it could be a sensory related issue. And so that would require kind of further investigation, maybe from a clinician or a pediatrician, especially if you're seeing that pretty repetitively and relatively frequently.
Okay, it's interesting. And tell me then as well, and I suppose the final question, Michelle. So when you are working with a family, like what does the process look like? I mean, if a family rings you for assistance, what is the process that you step through to help a family? And what are you hoping to achieve at the end of that kind of consultation period with them?
Yeah, so there's, you know, where I am, I kind of offer two services. So one is very clinical in nature, right? So you have a formal diagnosis of, let's say your child has ADHD or autism or any disruptive behavioral disorder. And then you're kind of going through the process where we do an evaluation, I do an assessment, a treatment plan, and then we create goals. And then I'm not only creating goals for the child, but I'm really creating goals for the parent as well. Because it's really parent, when we're talking about young children, we really want to do parent-directed intervention, because that's where you see the most outcomes. So that's kind of the traditional medical model. Outside of that, let's say so there's a lot of families that are kind of in this middle ground where maybe there's some family history, but my child doesn't have a full-blown diagnosis, or like I suspect something is going on and you don't maybe need clinical kind of treatment. But then I also provide coaching. So that's outside of the medical model, but we're doing all parent directed. So this is something that's just a little, I have further outreach, right? So like I can work with people outside of the state of California where I am and where I can provide that coaching. So kind of depends on what it is that you need support with. And if it's not within my scope or if it's not something that I can kind of support you with, then I can kind of direct you in that right direction.
Because I always think back on that show. I don't know if you remember, it was from a few years ago, The Super Nanny. Do you know the woman that sort of, you know, a bit like Mary Poppins, sort of flew into the family and,
yes, and sort of sorted she's out.
Very popular. I don't know where she's gone to. I sort of have that in my head that's kind of what you do. You sort of a bit like a sleeping kind of expert, you know, you sort of fly in and save the day. I might have to give you a call in about 2 years' time.
You know, it's actually really, even just within my area, like when I'm talking about like the true, more like medical model where you have a formal diagnosis, I find that, you know, this idea of doing therapy in a traditional way where the child comes to the office, if you think about that, there's not a lot of behaviors that are occurring, not likely in the office.
Yeah.
And so it's bringing the clinician to the environment where problem behavior is happening and looking at the environmental variables that are contributing to the behavior and making modifications that way. You see rapid change that way. And I think that that's, we're slowly going in that direction, but it's not very common.
Yeah, that's really interesting because you're right. You know, when you take a child to the doctor's surgery or something, they're always on their best behavior, aren't they? It's hardly
they
a
sure
true
are.
Reflection. And so tell me, how are your two children going, your 6 and your 3-year-old? You know, what is it having from your own learned experience? You know, what is it that sort of one tip that you can give to other parents in the same situation? If there was one that you could blend all your clinical experience with just your kind of on the ground at the coal face, what is that one tip that you'd give to all parents about dealing with toddlers?
Know what's important to you in terms of your parenting values. Make sure you and your partner are on the same age. Oh, sorry, I have to give you more than two. Okay.
You can give us as many as you like. I'm literally soaking all of this up.
The first thing is know your values as an individual and how you want to engage as a parent. Number two is, you know, have that discussion with your partner because there's so much parental disagreement about discipline. And that's where it just kind of all starts to fall apart, right? And if the two parents can agree on how they want to discipline and engage with their children, that's really important. And then number three is whatever you say, make sure you follow through. So if you are not willing to follow through with whatever it is that you have said, then don't say it at all. Because that follow through is really, really important. You need to show your children that I'm here for you. I love you. We are going to connect. But also when I am asking you to do something, especially around your safety, I want to make sure that you'll do it.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, isn't it? Particularly point two there around getting your partner or, you know, you're in on that discussion. Because I certainly remember in days gone by where, you know, the other side was comfortable with putting the child in the room and letting them sit there by themselves. But I felt very strongly that was the wrong way to do it. So that's a whole nother podcast in itself, I suspect.
It really is. I know. There's so many different topics we could cover around parenting. But yes, you know, like, timeouts, yes or no, spanking, yes or no. You know, one parent will be like, I was spanked. I turned out fine. I want to do that in our home. And the other parent is like, absolutely not. We're not doing this. So you guys got to have to like have a discussion, agree so that there's consistency for the children. So it's a predictable, loving environment for them.
Yeah, and there's so many different techniques because if you're open to learning them, like I learned the other week about conscious parenting and, you know, all these different things that we don't have titles for as parents. Like we said, we don't come in with a manual with a kind of a definition of what all these ones are. But, you know, there's a lot of these ones that you try and learn about and assimilate together, but actually it's quite confusing. I think that's why I go into mind blanks when I when I get into the heat of the moment because I'm thinking, which one are you pulling out here at any given time? But it doesn't really work if your partner's not aligned anyway, if the time out or the spanking or sitting in your room is their sort of way of responding. It's a difficult battle.
Correct. Correct. Absolutely.
And how do you deal with that with your husband or your partner? Just some personal advice.
Well, you know, my situation is not unique. So I am married to a child psychologist.
Oh, right.
So you get two behaviorists.
Oh, my goodness. Your children are going to be amazing.
We have strong, we come from strong behavioral backgrounds. So we speak the same language. We have the same science to support our parenting. And I have a note to say about this. I feel very strongly about this because there's this gentle parenting movement, this conscious parenting movement, and they're all really, really wonderful, right? Like treating our children with respect, getting to their level, right? These are wonderful things. But I think where they fall short is where they don't have a lot of evidence to support them. So they get you to a certain point and then you're really stuck and you're like, I don't really know how to move forward because I feel like I'm going to take a misstep. So for example, there's a lot of discussion about the use of timeout from positive reinforcement. When if you look at the scientific literature on this, it is dense and scientifically supported, but it's often not done properly. And so if you can get that support and education and know how to do it and say, yes, this will work, because actually there's four different types of timeout procedures. Sorry, quick note. By the way, I talked about all of this on my podcast because recess was taken away from my six-year-old, the full duration. And that's a hot topic here. But anyway, that's a timeout procedure, not done properly though.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I think that it's really important to kind of know what the science is. And I know that can be tricky to find, but that's really important in terms of like calming down all of the noise. But again, going back to, you know, parents need to agree on their approach and move forward.
Yes. Well, like I said, another whole podcast on that shortly. But Michelle, finally, I suppose, you know, coming back to the original question we posed at the beginning of this podcast, you know, should we or do we need to tame the toddler?
I would say no. No, you don't need to tame your toddler. Know who they are. Love them. Have good boundaries. Follow through with your boundaries. Create a safe and predictable environment. Like that's the foundation that you want.
Fantastic. Well, Michelle, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing all this wonderful expertise. And like I said, I've written lots of notes. I'll be taking all of that on board. But for our listeners, tell me, how can they get in touch with you and stay connected with you and your developments and interesting podcast too?
Yes, yes. You can email me. You can email me at thrivingtoddler@gmail.com. You can follow my podcast. It's called Parenting Understood. I co-host it with Dr. Erin O'Connor from New York University. She's the head of child development studies there. And then you can find me at thrivingtoddler.com.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, Michelle, so much. It's been so wonderful. And to everyone listening today, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of This Little Life. We hope you found our discussion today as enlightening and valuable as I did. And if you'd like to stay updated on our latest episodes and receive notifications about future releases, make sure you subscribe to our podcast on your favorite platform, whether it's Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And don't forget to leave us a review and share this podcast with your loved ones. Your feedback and support mean the absolute world to us. And if you have any suggestions for future topics or guests, feel free to reach out to us on our socials. You'll find us at The Little Oak Company. We'd love to hear from you. So until next time, take care and take some time to enjoy this little life.